Hi.
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 Is that how we started?
No, usually, you know, I say something like, this is on.NET.
Okay.
I'm your host, Bertrand Leroy. Rich is here with me. And today we have Meichin and Yan. Hi.
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 And today we're going to talk about CoreRT and .NET Native.
Yes.
So what is it? Where do people use it? What is it for?
You mean where we are using .NET Native,
yeah,
and what is it for?
Yeah.
Today, .NET Native has shipped with UWP. Is this a microphone fine?
Yeah, it sounds good.
With UWP scenarios,
yeah,
and it's tied to WinRT. And I think Yang can talk a little bit more about CoreRT. That is where we take .NET Native to the next step.
We should probably just clarify what UWP even is.
Universal Window Platform, correct?
Yeah, and so and what are those kind of apps?
It's a store apps in the Windows 10,
okay,
and pretty much depends on the WinRT stuff, like, you know, the XAML stack, everything kind of tied to Windows.
Okay.
Windows 10. Yes.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And before we go down into the technical stuff,
mm-hmm,
what does UWP have to do with like .NET Framework and .NET Core? Like how does it fit in?
.NET Framework. Are you referring to a desktop,
yeah,
or are you doing referring
you
to the .NET Core? Well, it actually has a different profile. That kind of window has certain ideas about the surface that we can see from the framework, right? Has a little bit smaller surface. I think it's closer to Windows 8 profiler API. How do you call it? The profile.
Windows 8 profile. I'm not sure,
yeah,
that everyone on the call would or on the show would understand what that is.
Mm. We take away some of the functionalities. For example, you do not have app domain. For example, you do not have reflection emit. Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's kind,
yeah,
of like intended to be sort of a
smaller,
modern set of APIs.
Modern and more secure, and some of the legacy stuff that we do not wish to carry forward at that,
right,
time. Yes.
So that's what we did. That's what we did in Windows 8.
That's right.
And I think we changed our plan a little bit as we.
You mean post Windows 10?
Well, a little bit in Windows 10.
Core.
We, you know, like I think one of the things people complained about was, rightfully, was like we only had generic collections and none of the non-generic ones, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then I,
mm-hmm,
think we pulled those in the Windows,
yes,
10.
Yes,
frame.
We did.
So,
yeah,
we're kind of on the path,
Richard,
to,
yeah, mm-hmm,
changing
to
it.
To enrich the, you know, the service, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, my main point was just making it clear what the scope of UWP is.
Mm-hmm.
Just for,
absolutely,
people who aren't,
yep,
familiar with that. Yeah. So it's for Windows Store apps.
That's right.
Cool.
Then we probably should go to,
yeah,
Yang and talk about,
right,
what's the next step for the .NET Native.
Before we start talking about what's the next step, it might be worth talking about like what the history of the project is, because that's always,
totally,
kind of interesting topic. So the start of the .NET Native, really started sometime in like 2006 or 2007 when a small group of people stopped looking at, hey, you know, like we have this like .NET framework, but that's really big, you know, it has like a lot of things together, and a lot of features kind of packaged together. So that group of people started looking at what would it take to build like minimal runtime for C# language, you know, like what's the minimal possible thing that you can build and still write code in C#.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think at the very first part
yeah,
we actually called the project Native C#.
There are different names for it. Like the name I think that was used for the longest time was Red Hawk. The project,
okay,
the project,
yes,
name was Red Hawk. You can actually see it in like number of places in the code base. If you just search for Red Hawk, you see it like mentioned in core CLR comments and, you know, CoreRT comments. And
right. Yeah, it's no secret.
Yeah. And it turns out that you actually, the minimal runtime can be really very minimal. It's basically just a GC with, that's the garbage collector, with just a couple of, you know, assembly helpers.
What are assembly helpers?
Assembly helpers are kind of the low-level routines that you right to interact with the low level things.
What are low level things?
Like, you know, for example, you know, like there are these like super there are these operations that need to be like super fast, so you kind of want to squeeze last instructions out of them. So you kind of don't want to write them in C++. You want to write them in assembly code.
Right. So this use of assembly isn't like .NET assemblies.
Yeah.
You're talking more about like assembler.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the machine code.
Yes. Yeah. And so what's one or two examples of one of those operations that you want to be crazy fast?
Like the best example is write barrier, because of the what we have in our runtimes is generational GC. And what generation GC needs in order to work, it needs to know when things are modified on the GC heap. So when you are assigning, you know, string to a field on an object, it's not just a simple assignment. There is some bookkeeping to do. And because of assignments happen a lot, you know, we kind of want to make sure that it's like super, super lean, super fast, mm-hmm. right?
So with that, like, you know, you said the one of the clear goals is it has to be super fast. So do you have a group of people that sometimes sit down and look at these assembly helpers and say like, oh, you know, this is kind of like six lines of assembly. I feel like if we kind of thought about this a different way, we'd get it down to like five or four.
Yeah.
Yeah. And does that actually happen? Like, you guys have been able to reduce this, the number of instructions?
Right. It's actually, if you look at the write barriers, how they, you know, like, if you, I think the, if you go all the way to .NET Framework 1.0, you know, the write barrier was, I don't know how many instructions, but we did shave, like, instruction here and there since then. So, so these, like, a lot of these things are basically data-driven. People look at the profiles and then say, yeah, hey, we are spending like 5% of the time here, so maybe we can, you know, squeeze a little bit of it, you know. And,
okay, sounds good. I think we covered that topic now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there are also a lot of names that are going to fly around in this mm-hmm. conversation that would be interesting to
yes.
not only define but explain what the difference are. Like, for example, what's the difference between what you're doing with native and what was done earlier with NGen? What's CIL? What's LLILC? All those things. What can you define some of the terms that are going
to
be used?
And also how it compares to what we did with Windows Phone. We talked about compiler in the cloud with this thing called Triton.
Mm-hmm.
How do all these things fit together?
Oh my gosh! I think you just asked a question that would need about 3 hours, right?
Okay, so three
you don't have 3 hours.
3 minutes sounds
three
good
minutes.
for that answer.
So where do we start?
Yeah, so let's think about where we start, right? I think you asked a bunch of different questions.
Yes.
I mean that's trying to finish what Yang was saying. Yang was saying that when we started .NET Native, even before .NET Native, there's Red Hawk. And that was actually targeted for like a low level, like system programmer. Actually, it was a driver developer that was adopted to it. So we actually trimmed back a lot of language on the C#. It's actually a very small subset of C#. That kind of proved the concept that C# can be very fast, as long as we do the right thing. And that's why we move on to .NET Native and to the opportunity, because for us, adoption and also compatibility is always the hardest one. With Windows 10 Store, we actually have a more closed ecosystem that we can intercept problems and also diagnose the problem early. And that's why we choose to kind of realize the .NET Native in the UWP scenario. And then we move on to the core RT that Yang was on the track to talk about it, that we actually do open source and try to bring it to cross-plat and also light up in the non-UWP scenario as well. And then Bertrand move on to another set of questions.
Like, I'm sorry.
You should be.
Well, did you cover NGen?
Not yet.
Okay,
that's why I was going to now switch to
okay.
NGen. Oh, maybe awesome. Yang, do you want to start from the NGen?
In the kind of early days of .NET, we only had a JIT, right?
And remind us what that is.
JIT is basically like a compiler that runs that translates the IL code, that's basically what the C# compiler is producing, and that conversion from the IL code to basically the machine instructions that actually get executed happens at runtime, right? Basically when you run your app. So that works great, but as you create bigger and bigger applications and bigger frameworks, the startup of the applications take a while. When you look at the profiles, you see that 90% of that time is spent cheating. So this actually became a problem way back, even before we shipped like .NET Framework 1.0 in like 2001. People did realize that it's a problem. So what we built at the time was this tool called Engine, and that basically allowed us, the Engine tool runs the conversion step from IL to machine code like upfront. And then when your application actually runs, it just uses the cached result. So it worked kind of, it served us well for a while with the in the full .NET framework. We kind of kept improving it. We built like this engine service that basically maintained this cache of engine images in the background. But it also had like number of problems, right? When something changes on your machine, like when let's say you get new version of the .NET framework, you have to regenerate all these engine images that you generated before, and if you have like a lot of things installed on your machine, it takes a while.
Right, because they're kind of fragile to their environment.
Yeah.
Or very dependent on a specific environment.
And it also, the reason why engine service worked because of the .NET framework was like global thing on the machine. It's basically took over the machine, you had to be admin to install it. So you kind of own the environment, right? But as we moved to kind of the new scenarios like devices, phones, the lockdown devices like Xbox, it's no longer possible to do this for a variety of reasons. One might be that the device might not be powerful enough, or the policies on the device might be prohibiting it, right? For example, on Xbox, all code has to be signed, so you cannot just generate code on the fly, right?
Right.
So that's why we started looking into like this ahead of time compilation, where you basically just like compile, compile some of it like not on the device, but somewhere else, either in cloud or when the application is developed. Right? So the first iteration of this was the project called Triton.
Yes.
Right. That's basically when we moved some of the compilation to cloud, and that's what we have used on phone, on Windows Phone, and it made things better, but it still didn't. It wasn't perfect, and
right.
The way the Triton worked, it moved part of the compilation to cloud, but there was still a step required on the device.
Right. The way I kind of think about Triton is, and these numbers are made up, but it's kind of like 7/8 of the compilation and computation are in the cloud. So, from a user experience, the amount of time that they have to wait on the device, it's much, much smaller. The amount that the device has to be powerful is much, much smaller. Mm-hmm. But you still have the code signing problem that you mentioned, because you still have an image that's like an executable image that's fundamentally being created mm-hmm. on the consumer machine.
Yeah.
And so it's still bad from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's effectively, I'd almost say, like, from a last mile perspective, mm-hmm. that's the problem we were trying to solve with .NET Native, is that piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also want to point it out that on the Windows 8 or the Phone 8 timeframe, it's actually a very big learning process for us. There's a lot of constraints that show up that was not imposed on us before. For example, signing, code integrity, how safe it is, and battery life. And because, as Yang pointed out, long time ago, well, not long time ago, today we still have an engine, right? Engine is pretty much just, you know, priming all the DLLs for you. It does take time. And when it takes time, we take CPU time, you drain the battery. And so we were trying to be very smart on where we hide the engine time, like 2 a.m. or maybe some idle time. And it was fine until phone comes along. I'm 32, and a battery lifetime, certainly everything is an issue, right? So how do you reduce the battery draining? When is a good time to do that? And also, with ARM32, it's a less powerful chip in a way. So I think the reason that the Phone 8 was using Triton, but Windows 8 did not use Triton, this actually architecture also plays a kind of a decision point. With ARM32, when we're trying to port just 32 to ARM32, we realize that we are 4x slower than what we expected. So when you kind of, we have a performance team, when you do some sort of projection about how long it will take and how much battery will drain and how many apps that you need to recompile when firmware got updated, we quickly realize engine is not a solution for mobile devices.
Right, you were basically able to tell that from a back of the napkin type exercise.
Yes.
And realize you need to build a different product.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Right, so...
But we did not have time to go all the way to native because we were actually sitting on Triton technology before we figure out a place that we can realize for 2 years. But we are not close enough to kind of push out all the way and to like a .NET Native solution. And that is why, you know, Triton was more of the best solution that we have at that time that need to be delivered in time.
Sure. Yeah. So maybe we should switch back to .NET Native. Mm-hmm. I think what would be useful is to understand, like, is .NET Native just one thing, or are there kind of separate parts that you can kind of talk about? This is a little bit back to Bertrand's question on, like, where ILC fits, for example. You know, from a developer standpoint, what are the parts that actually get used from, you know, they're in Visual Studio,
mm-hmm.
they press, like, F5 or build, and eventually they're running an app. What mm-hmm. are the different components that get pulled in?
Young, you want to try that?
So the .NET Native product, right, it's composed of the, it has basically like special version of the framework that was like refactored and, you know, redesigned in places to make it smaller and to make it friendly for the full precompilation. For example, you know, some parts of the framework emit code at runtime and then, you know, use JIT to compile it. So if you are doing full precompilation, that doesn't work anymore. You kind of need to have alternative way,
right,
strategy to do that. Right?
Is that like APIs that as part of their implementation use ref emit?
Yeah.
Would that be one of the
cases?
Yeah,
that's a good example.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So this framework, then there is the compiler that basically takes the IL and produces machine code like ahead of time. For .NET Native, for UWP, we are using a version of the optimizer from the C++ backend. It's kind of same kind of optimizer as what the C++ compiler has.
And do you get a bunch of the same benefits, or?
It's kind of, you know, it's kind of this like heavy duty optimizer that was tuned for a long time, you know, for C++. But you know, there are some specific optimizations that are for C#, but a lot of the optimizations that you get for C++ apply to C# as well, right?
Nice.
One of the good ones are, for example, auto vectorization, right?
I love that optimization.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's basically like what auto vectorization does. It looks at the loops in your program and, you know, looks at the patterns that the loops, the code patterns in the code, and see whether there are like these like super parallel instructions that, you know, modern C processors have that can be used to execute that code, right?
Think about it. Developer today had to write SIMD, use our SIMD libraries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Think about if you don't have to explicitly use SIMD, and then optimization just happen for you.
Right. Yeah. Of course, you know, like these optimizations take time, so they
absolutely
are like not as good candidates for like JIT environment, right?
Totally not.
Yeah. Right. So there's the optimizer, and then there is like the component that is specific to dealing with WinRT specifics to generate basically the interop or the bindings with the WinRT API so that you can use them in C# seamlessly.
Is that kind of similar to the bindings that Xamarin has with iOS?
Yeah, it's
and
like
Android?
From 10,000 feet view, it's similar, but you know, the technology, the details are different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's certainly satisfying the same scenario
mm-hmm.
and requirement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, WinRT is like, in a sense, it's like Windows specific kind of OS. It's basically a way how Windows are exposing all the new APIs. So it's equivalent to, you know, the Android Java APIs on Android and mm-hmm. or the OS X or the Objective-C APIs on iPhones.
Yeah.
Right.
So did you just describe what ILC is by those couple things?
I'm kind of describing what the .NET Native product contains,
yeah.
right? Like what's in the box when you kind of click on the checkbox install .NET Native. These are the parts that you are getting, right?
Yeah. I usually think about that because we don't have JIT. So a lot of things that we depend on JIT to do at runtime, we had to do it AOT,
mm-hmm.
Ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
compiler.
Yeah.
And such as like reflection,
mm-hmm.
right? Some of the reflection services that
yeah.
we had to do in the whole program analysis, trying to predict what kind of reflection data we need to support, or like invocation target, delegates. They actually, all those transform is kind of, and calculation of the target is happening in ILC. And that's why ILC took a long time, because first of all, you had to do a whole program analysis, trying to figure out all the support services that you need, interrupt, reflection, or generic instantiation. And then there's a backend pipe in UTC that does a whole program optimization for you. And so I think that's probably pretty much under the hood of what is happening in ILC.
Okay, right. So we just had a couple of terms there, term explosion.
Yes, totally.
yeah, so ILC, that thing we keep on talking about, I think that stands for just IL compiler. So,
correct.
Yeah, so
yes.
That's just a
yes.
simple name. You said UTC. That's just
yeah.
kind of a different name.
Universal Topple Compiler.
Yeah,
that's
right?
UTC
yeah.
is basically the name of
the
C++ optimizer backend.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Okay, that we got that one covered. And then another one that I think a bunch of people won't get is generic instantiation. Tell me what those are.
How would you describe it?
Generics, or you know, a lot of kind of the modern languages have this like concept of generics. You know, in C++, it's templates. But what those things translate into when they are compiled into machine code, they basically like are stamping the code or variants of the code, right? But the trap that is easy to get into is that you write a program and it's pretty simple program, but suddenly that thing needs like many or potentially even an infinite number of these like stamps of code. Right.
Right. It's list of string versus list of int. Right.
Yeah. That one is easy. That one is like not that bad, right? You kind of have like one copy of the code for list of string, other one for list of int.
Or
right?
list of dictionary of int string and list of dictionary of
Exactly. That's where it becomes more interesting, right?
The way I kind of think about generic instantiations is when I'm looking at documentation on MSDN, I see list of T. And the T is unspecified because it's basically saying it can be anything. So that's an open, that's currently an open type. Yeah. It's open to being filled. And then when you actually use it in your code, when you have like a list of dictionary of int string, then that's a, that generic has been closed. And that's, to me, it's it, that's not exactly the instantiation.
I know, that's why I was thinking about in my head. I mean, so many years, David trying to educate me about generic instantiation. In my head, I think kind of thinking about it two ways. One is actually more of the E class, like kind of class representation, like a list of int, for example, what kind of, you know, interface it has, the field layout, the data structure, the, you know, runtime representation. The other one is your piece of code when you want to execute on it, right? So I think specified type must exist for you to execute.
Yeah, however, is that kind of like calling new almost?
Yeah, kind of. Just thinking about the thing that you're backing the new, right? Yeah. And then in terms of execute the code, backing the execution, some of them you can generate more of a slow version of it and everybody can share. And then you can also have more specific code gen that you can actually keep in for optimization. For example, your list of T, if T is an arbitrary class or like a big value type, or like a, if it's just a, you know, int, then the codegen for it could be very different because, for example, int, you probably can register it in codegen, right? But not arbitrary size or value type. So I always think about there could be code sharing, but not as optimized. There could be more copy of code for the same IO that you write that is more optimized. However, every single instantiation that you run, it must have a specific runtime data structure representing it. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. So, okay, so you talked about the tooling or the tool chain. So there must be a runtime still.
Yes.
Where does that fit in?
Yeah, there's like the basically like evolution of the .NET Red Hook runtime that basically the framework sits on top of, you know. And, you know, the last part that we didn't talk about that is like that, you know, there's like debugger build system so that you can actually press F5 in Visual Studio and it gets built and, you know, hit your breakpoint and so on, right?
And so if you go through that whole process and you write Hello World, what's kind of the size of the most minimal .NET native app today?
Single file is what, 6 megabyte?
Yeah, it's like in the order of megabytes. Yeah. We don't, you know, the if you are talking about the Venati Hello World apps, right, they are kind of not just doing Hello World console write line Hello World, they kind of have a bunch of the, you know, UI parts in it. Yeah, that's I think it's like around 5 megabytes.
So, yeah,
so that's like Hello World XAML.
Yeah.
Yes, because Venati use a lot of generic, and for a ahead of time compiler, there are certain areas that are really, really hard to deal with. Reflection certainly is a place, and the other one is actually the generic. And Venati, unfortunately, use a lot of generic and also the projection. So the size blow and getting the size under control was actually pretty tough problem. Yep.
Sounds like it.
It is. Mm-hmm. Just trust us.
So what about pruning the tree of code that you need to have in the executable once you've compiled? Are you doing anything with that similar to what the Xamarin linker is doing? Where is that headed?
Totally.
But like, you know, to get the reasonable size, we do have we do this kind of pruning. It's kind of similar technology to what Xamarin has, and we are actually like in active discussions with them right now whether we can kind of merge it or start sharing it, you know.
So does a developer, if I'm writing an app, do I have to be kind of cognizant of whether my app is friendly to be pruned and made smaller by the tooling? Like, do I get any feedback back to say, like, I tried to prune your app, but I couldn't because of the way you wrote it?
Yeah, we don't have that kind of feedback that tells you, hey, you know, we cannot prune it. We basically just don't prune it, and you see like big exe at the end, right? So that may be something we can do better at, like telling people, hey, you know, if you write these five lines differently, your exe will be 5 megabytes smaller.
We actually have been spending a lot of time trying to tune our whole program's analysis to be more aware about certain code patterns that could cause explosion. And in addition to that, we also have implemented a bunch of the technology and trying to shrink down the explosion as well. If I look back, I mean, Yang and I have been working on .NET Native for like the past 4 years. Okay, so whole program analysis, I think we built it 3 times. The first time you build it, pretty much the size just explode. We couldn't even finish compilation. And I remember one of the developers came to me and said, can we switch ILC to 64-bit? So you wouldn't run out of it. Yes, Richard, go sign. And my mind says, no, go fix your problem. Then they build another one, right? Once the size is controlled, we finally managed to compile it, and then we're trying to stand up some of the applications. You know what? It took us 3 weeks to stand up one store application. And then you know the logic that you build in was not quite right. So that's why I say, you know, the whole program analysis is actually a very complex problem. There's a lot of things that you do in reflection or even C# dynamic keyword. What's the semantics of it? What expect to be kept, right? Those are extremely hard. And there are certain patterns that are extremely difficult for keep the size small, for example, entity framework. If you look at we shipped the .NET Native last year in June. When I say last year, it was 2015. The size explosion happened in generic virtual method, GVM. Now I'm not doing the terminology without explaining it, right?
Yeah.
That one actually explodes. And then also reflection does not just work. You really have to be very careful about your reflection pattern. There are certain reflection API make AOT extremely hard, like make generic method, make generic type. And sometimes that type name is actually a string somewhere you receive later that you don't even know, right? So those things actually, it's not general reflection make it hard, but they are enough, like, you know, just a handful of API make it really hard.
Edge cases.
Yes, edge cases. Unfortunately, those edge cases was used in many places that we built in our framework, like a C# runtime, right? So we believe that we are actually on a path that we can cover most of those kind of explosion cases, like GVM, we already taken care of that. Reflection, we take care of that. Recursive generic also caused explosion. Yes, Richard, let's sign about that one.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was one point we talked about, should we just decide, like, you know, the depth of the instantiation is just fixed, right? And what if you pass that, what do we do? But I think now we have a solution for that. And then now we are actually working on a solution for WinRT to trim down the size. So I think in general, technology was heading into the right direction. We do,
cool.
It's a complex problem. We need a bit of time. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So are all those problems the basic reason why the native switch on the .NET Core CLI was?
You mean talk about a debug and release build using a different runtime?
No. I'm talking about, there were some pre-release versions of .NET Core where the dash native flag was on the was available and it was removed. Are all those unfinished things part of the reason for
a native switch was
right? Basically, like when we initially started to do the .NET CLI tooling, right?
Yes.
We kind of didn't know exactly what is it. We kind of, you know, ran fast, and so we said, okay, we have this native compilation. Let's try to add the native compilation support to it as well. And you know, as we are heading with kind of, you know, productizing it with like release version, we kind of trimmed the things that are like not fully baked yet. You know, like I do expect that we will add this back as, you know, as we mature the core RT and, you know, like as the .NET native core RT becomes available for the console apps.
Yeah. Remember, we don't support console app yet,
yeah.
and we don't support Linux yet. Yeah. So Dynacore is actually more broader in terms of like where it supports.
I'm asking because I got the question several times.
Mm-hmm. Really? Okay.
When the native switch would come back.
A lot of it was actually, you know, like also had to do with the conversion to MS Build because of all that plumbing, needs to be redone, right? So
right.
we do actually have in the Korati repo, if you look, there's like MS Build targets file that's kind of set up so that, you know, once the MS Build MS Build integration is like ready, then we should be able to just, you know, adjust it and, you know, plug it into what will be in there.
That makes sense.
So do you think, though, that we are going to get, so there's this CoreRT project.
Mm-hmm.
It's on GitHub. I think it's github.com/.net/CoreRT.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's out there. So I guess, I was going to ask a different question, but is that like the new .NET native? Like, how should I think about that? Is that the cross-plat .NET native? What does that represent, that repository?
It's basically the parts of .NET Native that we have open sourced. So what you will find in there is the pretty much the whole framework is open sourced for Korati. The core runtime, the Red Hawk runtime, is open sourced. We are using Ryujit as the compiler, or as the IL to native code translation for the native code IL to native code translation step today. My reason is that we kind of want to have open source solution for that and cross platform solution for that, and Ryujit is the only one that fits that bill today.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the Korati repo is.
Right, but will it at some point, kind of back to Bertrand's uh-huh. question? You know, when the native switch comes back,
uh-huh.
Will it be the CoreRT repository that's kind of providing that?
Mm-hmm.
And also, you said that what's there is the parts that we have open sourced.
Mm-hmm.
When we get to this point and we've kind of productized it, will everything be there? Will it be complete with respect to what you're using, or will there be some stuff still missing?
I think we will have there like something that's like complete solution, right?
Okay.
Whether the optimizer that we use for the UWP apps on Windows today,
I wasn't talking about that. Yeah. I just meant from the perspective of if I want to build a console app with that, I'm thinking from a .NET Core perspective,
yes.
a console app that I can run on Linux, Mac, and Windows.
Yeah. So
will those things be there?
Yeah. We actually, a lot of the technology that's used in the Korati isn't actually in the Korati, right? We use GC and exact same GC as in Core CLR, right? We use Ryujit that's actually in Core CLR.
Yes.
We use the CoreFX framework that, like, the Korati repo only contains the low-level framework. Most of the framework code is actually in CoreFX repo. So what's in the Korati repo is kind of this like sort of lower level of the runtimes, kind of some kind of glue code, to stitch everything together. So
it's only the parts that need to be different.
Yeah,
effectively.
Exactly.
Okay, makes sense. I have another question then, which is, I heard this whole discussion about, like, on some devices, you didn't say this, but iOS comes to mind. You did say Xbox and also Windows Store. Like, by policy, you have to have ahead of time, like 100% ahead of time compiled app.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. But, my app doesn't run in those kind of environments. It either runs on Windows Desktop or on a Linux server. And so, it sounds like AOT has some benefits, but I don't know why I would necessarily want to go all the way. Like, is there a solution that says like, oh, here are the places where AOT provides awesome benefits, but it also has a JIT, and so you have the JIT benefits. Is there some kind of hybrid solution that would actually be better for places where you're not so policy constrained?
That's basically what we have in Core CLI today, right? In Core CLI today, you can use CrossGen to pre-compile stuff. And, you know, there's still JIT at runtime that you kind of can fall back to for the things that didn't get pre-compiled, right? So, no.
Okay, so then if we have a solution that roughly meets those requirements today, when we get the native switch back, what is Core RT going to give above and beyond what Core CLR plus CrossGen provide today?
You know, if we are like, I think the unique kind of spot for Core RT will be kind of the minimal size. Right? So if you are falling back to JIT, that still has like, you have to carry a lot of stuff with you, right? So if you just want the minimal kind of Docker container with just your app, right? Having a JIT for it, if you can just like precompile everything and your app doesn't have like those bad cases of generic explosion and those things, right? You will kind of get the best you can get.
The deployment is much easier because all your dependency was compiled in, right? So then you can think about twofold of benefit. You're asking about why, you know, what does that give to us? One is actually its deployment, and the other one is actually performance, the startup.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing like, if I, for my workload, if I'm really trying to hit a particular size envelope, then Core RT will definitely be better for helping me do that.
Absolutely.
Now, on the performance, I assume you're talking about startup.
That's correct.
Is the benefit of Core RT significant above Core CLR plus CrossGen?
I think it's much easier if we compare from the UWP points, because at UWP, we have already data gathering. And on the you know, the non-UWP scenario, we don't have enough backup data to do aggregation statement.
Got it.
In UWP scenario, we are seeing about 30 to 50% of startup wins with Dynamo Native. And we believe it is transferable because it's not just one application, it's a backup application that we look at. Another important fact to look at it is actually our performance architect mentioned that in UWP app startup, a lot of time was actually spending on XAML. So the differences of the runtime startup may be greater than what we see in UWP scenario when we take it out to a console application. But again, it's really too early and too premature to draw any conclusion from the, you know, console.
Right. But with that particular investigation, I actually don't know anything about it, but I'm just guessing that, like, was that an apples to apples comparison where the UWP app was cross-genned to make to?
It was engined.
Oh, it was?
Yes.
Okay, so it was?
Yes.
Yeah, so it was apples to apples.
Yes.
But, you know, it's kind of, there are a lot of, you know, details, you know, that, for example, like the UWP apps depend on a lot of the Vinati interop, but that is kind of expensive to do. That's more expensive in Core CLI than it's in the pre-compiled environment, right? So a lot of it depends on kind of what exactly the app is doing. And I believe that there's like some, you know, kind of section of the apps that, you know, benefit, that would benefit like 10x, you know. Then there's section of the apps that, you know, it may be kind of wash. And then there may be a section of the apps that where the full precompilation might actually hurt them, you know, when if the apps depend on kind of a lot of the dynamic code generation and those kind of thing, those kind of constructs that have to be basically interpreted or executed less efficiently in the fully precompiled world, right? They can become slower.
Right. So to a degree, it depends.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Is that your last question?
That was my last question that I had in my head.
Okay, well, you know, unless you have something that you want to announce.
Or yeah, any announcements?
Do we have any announcement?
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Don't well, feel that you have to.
You know, like
tune into a connect. Yeah,
yes, yes, that's a good
Isn't
one.
Isn't that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So when is that? November
16th.
Okay, yes, you so. Got a time right then. Date right, right? Okay, I November 16th. Tune into a connect.
If I'm wrong, I will put a
and it's a boat transport.
Yeah. Yes, everything is my fault. Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. That
thank
was very
so
interesting.
Much. Yeah.
And yeah, we should have had you guys on the show earlier. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. As an apology. Thank you, Richard. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As yeah. always.
Yes.
And thank you Kendra.
Yes. Yeah, Kendra, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. I've been here the whole time.
Yes.
Sorry that the audio was a little low in the beginning. My bad.
It's okay.
You're doing great. Yeah.
Well, thank you again for being here every week and making the show actually work.
No problem.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Yeah. And thanks everyone for tuning in. And we'll be back next week. I don't know who the guest will be next week.
Not me.
Not you. Bye everyone.
Yeah.
Bye.